From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we remember Carl Perkins, one of the originators of rockabilly, the music that in the mid-50s brought together rock and roll and country music. Perkins died yesterday at the age of 65 of complications from a series of strokes. Perkins wrote the song Blue Suede Shoes, which was a big hit for him as well as for Elvis Presley. And he wrote Honey Don't, which the Beatles recorded. We'll listen back to our 1996 interview with Carl Perkins. Just last fall, Lloyd Schwartz told us about the little-known American pianist George Copeland, whose recordings were regrettably out of print. Well, now his Victor recordings from the 1930s are finally available again. Lloyd has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Israeli Prime Minister is meeting President Clinton at the White House today. Benjamin Netanyahu hasn't publicly discussed a plan to withdraw Israeli troops from the West Bank, but said only the plan will permit Israel to defend itself. President Clinton has also not discussed the plan, but did remark today that it is in the Palestinians' interest to resolve the peace negotiations with Israel rather than fight. Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat warned of more violence today if demands for a Palestinian state on the West Bank are not met. Iraq and UN officials have set up technical evaluations to determine how much progress has been made toward disarmament. NPR's Eric Weiner reports from Baghdad.
The UN's chief weapons inspector, Richard Butler, reached the agreement today with Iraq's Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz. Beginning next month, technical experts from the five members of the UN Security Council, as well as Germany, will evaluate Iraq's chemical, biological, and missile weapons programs. A clean bill of health from the technical experts could lead to what Iraq and the UN both say they want, a lifting of sanctions. Today's agreement represents the first tangible progress since Richard Butler arrived here yesterday, but many issues remain to be resolved, including the composition of the inspection teams and whether those inspectors will have access to Saddam Hussein's presidential palaces and other so-called sensitive sites. Eric Weiner, NPR News, Baghdad.
Butler also says he's talking with Iraqi leaders about a new deadline set by Saddam Hussein, who wants all weapons inspectors to finish their work by the middle of May. Cuba is preparing to welcome Pope John Paul. The country's official news agency says government workers will get time off with pay tomorrow for the pontiff's arrival in Havana. Baton Rouge authorities have arrested a 19-year-old student for allegedly killing a man during a parade honoring Martin Luther King yesterday. Three children were wounded in the gunfire. Tara Giddy of Louisiana Public Radio reports.
Brandon Lionel Johnson was charged with one count of first-degree murder and three counts of attempted first-degree murder for the shooting which sent a crowd of parents and students scattering along a busy downtown thoroughfare. Family members brought Johnson to the police station late Monday night. Police believe Johnson fired his gun after his friend and James J.B. Carter got into a fight. Carter, who just celebrated his birthday last Tuesday, died of a head wound on the way to the hospital. Authorities are probing whether the argument could stem from a fight last Friday during a band practice for the high school students selected to march in the parade. The three injured children, ages 7, 9, and 11, remain hospitalized. All three were bystanders there to watch the parade honoring King. For NPR News, I'm Tara Guidry in Baton Rouge.
On Wall Street, the Dow's up 27 points at 7,780. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is beginning the trading week on an up note. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports from New York.
The market's positive tone is reflective of two major factors. First is the notion that interest rates will remain stable. Second is that earnings growth should not be compromised too severely by the events in Asia, although a few of the nation's money center banks are reporting that the economic turmoil in the Pacific Rim hurt their fourth quarter profits. J.P. Morgan was the hardest hit with a 35% drop in net income. On the positive side, there were stronger than expected results from names that include Lucent Technologies and Continental Airlines. Shares in American Home Products are rallying. On word, the company is considering a merger with Britain's SmithKline Beecham in a move that would create the world's biggest drug and consumer health care products company. I'm Doug Krisner.
The nation's two biggest banks are reporting strong earnings for the fourth quarter of last year. Chase Manhattan and Citicorp both sped past analysts' estimates with their results. IBM is also to report earnings news today, and McDonald's and Microsoft will do the same later this week. A published report says three computer firms and most local phone companies are devising a new computer modem that will let Internet users access pages on the World Wide Web 30 times faster than people do now. The New York Times reports the modem would stay connected to the web all the time, and the companies hope to debut the product by the end of the year. United Parcel Service and the Independent Pilots Association have reached a tentative agreement on a new contract. Both sides spent 2 years negotiating. Details of the pact have not yet been publicly released. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, a place to satisfy existing curiosities and discover new ones. Location information at 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Carl Perkins, one of the originators of rockabilly, died yesterday of complications related to a series of strokes. He was 65. We're going to remember him today by playing back a 1996 interview. Our conversation between mystery writer P.D. James and Fresh Air book critic Maureen Corrigan has been postponed until tomorrow. Carl Perkins' singing, guitar playing, and songwriting brought together country and rock and roll. He recorded at Sun Records in Memphis during the label's heyday, when its roster included Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, and Johnny Cash. Perkins was probably best known for writing the song Blue Suede Shoes. In 1956, his version of Blue Suede Shoes was a pop, rhythm and blues, and country hit. Then Elvis had a huge hit with the song. Perkins also wrote Honey Don't, which was recorded by the Beatles. More recently, his songs were recorded by Dolly Parton, the Judds, and George Strait. Here's Perkins performing his best-known song.
Well, it's one for the money, two for the show, three to get ready. Now go, cat, go, but don't you step on my blue suede shoe. You can do anything but lay off of my blue suede shoe. Well, you can knock me down, step in my face, slander my name all over the place, and do anything that you wanna do. But honey, lay off of my shoes, and don't you step on my blue suede shoes. You can do anything but lay off of my blue suede shoes.
Carl Perkins, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'd love to hear the story of how you wrote Blue Suede Shoes.
Well, I'd love to share it with you. It was October the 21st, 1955. I was playing what we called back in those days a honky-tonk. They call them clubs now, but it was a honky-tonk where people get together and scream and holler and dance and have a good time. And I had not owned a pair of blue suede shoes at this point. I'd seen a few of them around my hometown in Jackson, Tennessee. But at the end of a song, this couple had been dancing, a very attractive young lady and a cat that had on a pair of blue suedes. And at the end of the song, he said, don't step on my suedes. And it bothered me, you know, not having owned a pair. I didn't realize that, you know, if you step on them, you kind of got to brush them off a little bit. It discolors the toe of them. But the thing that bothered me was he thought that much of a pair of stupid shoes to actually hurt her feelings. So I went home that night, and I could not go to sleep. I mean, I just kept seeing her face. And she said, oh, I'm sorry. And she really was. And I laid there and I thought of the old nursery rhyme, one for the money, two for the show, three get ready, and four to go. I got up, went down the concrete steps. I was living in a government project house. And I got my guitar down and I said, well, it's a one for the money, dun-dun, two for the show. And I never will forget, I couldn't find any paper to write on because we had two small children, my wife Valda, who thank God is still with me after 44 years. We all of our folks lived close by, so I guess we had no need to have you know, writing paper. So I took 3 Irish potatoes out of a brown paper sack.
Oh, no.
I did. And bless her heart, she saved that sack. The original words to Blue Suede Shoes is hanging in my den in Jackson, Tennessee. And I never will forget. I called Sam Phillips at Sun Studios down here in Memphis, who had a boy by the name of Elvis, who had a couple of records already out at that time. And I said, "Mr. Phillips, I wrote me a good song last night." He said, "What is it?" I said, "I guess we'll call it maybe Blue Suede Shoes." He said, "Is it anything like old them golden slippers?" I said, "No, man, this is about a cat that don't want nobody stepping on." He said, "It sounds interesting."
Now, as you pointed out, the nursery rhyme is 3 to get ready and 4 to go. So how did it become Go Cat Go?
Well, the original line there that I came up with, I said, 3 to get ready, now go, man, go. I wrote the song Go, Man, Go. And the first attempt I made at recording it, I said, "Go, man." And then I got excited because I could tell through the glass control window that Mr. Phillips was liking this song. And I got excited and forgot the word man. There, on my original record, there is a slight pause. I said, 3 to get ready, now go, cat, go, but don't you. The word cat flew in there instead of man, and after I got through with it, he said, "That's it." I said, "Mr. Phillips, I made a terrible mistake. I call that man a cat." He said, "I heard you, and he's going to stay a cat."
Now, this was the first rock and roll record to top the pop charts, rhythm and blues charts, and country charts at the same time.
Yeah, it was.
And a lot of people made their own recordings of Blue Suede Shoes, Lawrence Welk among them.
Yeah, he sure did. Pee Wee King and the Golden West Cowboys. There was every kind of version. And, you know, to this day, Cherry, this song still gets put on albums all around the world. It's amazing. You ought to hear it in the Japanese language.
Yeah. Now, of course, Elvis Presley. Did a version of your song.
Yeah.
How did he end up doing it?
Well, I'm glad you asked me that because I'd like for as many people as possible to know this about this wonderful boy. I knew Elvis in 1954 when I first came to Sun Records. I worked the schoolhouses. We were booked by the same disc jockey here in Memphis, a fellow by the name of Bob Neal. We played high school auditoriums together. I thought I recognized a super talent. This boy was one of the nicest fellows I'd ever been around off the stage. And when he hit the stage, he was just completely generated, high-powered, hip-shaking. He couldn't help that. He wouldn't. You can go back and find where a lot of people copied Elvis, but you can't find who Elvis copied. Elvis was an original. And, you know, this guy was absolutely great. And I'm leading up to answer your question. When my record came out, January the 2nd, 1956, of Blue Suede Shoes, RCA Victor contacted Elvis. They had bought him from Sun Records at that point. And they said, "Elvis, there's a hit song out there. We want you to get in the studio and record it." He said, "There's a lot of hits out there. What are you talking about?" And Steve Sholes allegedly was a man who recorded Elvis back in the early part of his career. Victor said, "The song's Blue Suede Shoes." He said, "Yes, sir, you're right. I think it's a hit song myself. But that's my friend, Carl Perkins, and that's a Sun record." And he didn't want to do that song at the time they wanted him to, which was in January of 1956. He waited until April of that year, letting my record do what it was going to, and then he recorded it. And that was the kind of guy he was. You know, he could have jumped on it first, and nobody would have ever known Carl Perkins existed. But because of the nature of this fine individual human being named Elvis, he wanted me to have success with it, and he thought I would have if he stayed off of it, and that's what he did.
What do you think of his version?
I loved it. You know, I fell into the trap. Elvis did it faster than I did. And I love, in the music industry, we call it the groove. The beat that he put to it was up-tempoed from mine quite a bit. And I loved his so much till I drifted into doing it like he did, you know, faster. And when I met the Beatles in 1964 in England, and we was at a party, and they wanted me to do, you know, Blue Suede Shoes, and I did. And Harrison said, "Why don't you do it like you did it?" I said, "Well, I think I am." He said, "No, you're not. My record was, well, it's a one for the money, dun-dun-dun, a definite two stops, you know, and Elvis was, well, it's a one for the money, two for the show, pow." It was a one lick, and Harrison was really disturbed with that. He said, "Man, you do it different than anybody ever did, and now you're doing it like everybody else." But I really liked Elvis's record of it. I still, to this day, do. And I catch myself unconsciously speeding it up to the very groove he had it.
Well, I'm going to play Elvis's version of your song, Blue Suede Shoes.
Go, Cat.
Well, it's one for the money, two for the show, three to get ready. Now, go, Cat, go, but don't you step on my blue suede shoe. Well, you can do anything but take me over my blue suede shoe. Well, you can knock me down, step in my face, slander my name all over the place. Well, do anything that you want to do, but not, honey, lay off them shoes and don't you.
That's Elvis Presley singing Carl Perkins' song Blue Suede Shoes. Carl Perkins is my guest. He has a new autobiography called Go Cat Go. When Elvis Presley had his hit of this, you were in the hospital recovering from a car accident?
That's right. Yeah, I had a very serious accident on my way to the Perry Como show, March the 22nd of the year 1956. And I watched Elvis from my hospital bed on the Jackie Gleason show, I believe it was, or maybe the Dorsey Brothers. It was one of the early appearances, and he said, "I'm going to do my new record." I was in a cast from my waist up. I got a fractured neck. My shoulder was broke. I was hurt pretty bad, as well as my brother, who died as a result of that wreck. But he said, "I want to do my new record." "Well, there's a one for the money." And I like to broke out of my cast. I said, "Wow." And I mean, it was exciting because I didn't know that he was going to record it. And when I saw him do it live, I was real proud.
We're listening to a 1996 interview with Carl Perkins, who died yesterday at the age of 65. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our 1996 interview with Carl Perkins. Did you think of yourself as trying something new, of bringing together rock and roll and country?
Well, we didn't know exactly what we were doing, Terry, but we did know that it was different. We did know that instead of leaning back and sitting comfortably in their theater seats or wherever we were playing, these people were scooting around, moving. Some were getting up, shaking. Young people were dancing in the aisles. And we knew that we were causing a stir with this, and it wasn't, as far as I was concerned or any of the guys in the early days, we didn't feel like it was anything wrong with what we were doing. We were just putting life into, we borrowed from country, we borrowed from rhythm and blues and southern gospel, and so that's what it was.
So everybody was moving around in a frenzy when you were playing. What were you doing on stage when you
were playing? I was moving with them. I was jumping out of my shoes, jumping back in them, across them. You know, and I still, even at 64 years old, I cannot stand still on stage and play rockabilly music. I can't. I don't jump as high and as far, but I move. I can't do it any other way, you know.
Did you develop that style playing in honky-tonks?
Oh, yeah. You move there because of a flying bottle or an ashtray flying at some cat's head close to the stage. Yeah, you're on your toes playing in those places. And even, you know, back in those years, I was playing the same kind of music that was later recorded in Memphis in 54. I started playing the tonks when I was, 16, 17 years old. And I played. I did Roy Acuff's Great Speckled Bird or Wabash Cannonball, but I said, what a beautiful thought. Lord, I'm thinking. That old upright bass. My daddy used to tell me, he'd say, son, put that guitar back on the nail. You are messing up Mr. Acuff's song. He don't do it that fast, and ain't no need in you doing it. And rest my mama's soul, it was her who would say, Buck, leave the little fellow alone. He's not hurting Mr. Acuff's song. And because of what she would say to him, he backed off of me. And I just always felt good playing my songs up-tempo because that's the music I heard in the cotton fields. I picked cotton with many, many black people, and we'd start singing. They would. And I'd start singing with them 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon with the sun beating down on you. You know, I can hear Uncle John Westbrook say, about 10 rows over, Sister Juanita, whoa, whoa, yeah. And my little blood would start boiling. I said, wow, they fixing to sing. Gonna lay down my burdens. The ones who didn't know the words used their voices. And to this day, Terry, I can vividly hear that up-tempo gospel music. Then I'd go home at night and get my old beat-up guitar off of the wall from the nail, and I tried to make the strings, you know, sound like the voices I was hearing. When I do Some Glad Morning, my bass string is going doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo. That was filling in for the sounds of the voices I heard in the cotton fields. I grew up that way. Nobody told me it was wrong. That wasn't the way to play music. So I just stayed with it, and I'm still with it.
Now, your guitar sound was also influenced, I think, by Les Paul, and I think the first guitar you really loved was a Les Paul guitar.
Oh, tell me about it. I paid $5 a week on that jewel in 1954. I wore the end of my nose off standing on the outside of the music store with my nose pressed against the window looking in at it. And finally, Mr. John Towater, who owned the music store, came to the front door. My brother Jay and I, he said, come in, guys. He'd been seeing us stand out there on Saturdays. And he got that guitar down off the rack and handed it to me. And I must have had a certain look about me because he told me after then, he said, I just couldn't take it away from you. I just felt that guitar would inspire you, and it did that.
What did you like about Les Paul's sound that you wanted to get yourself?
Well, he had he was way ahead of his time, and by that I mean he was a cat that understood electronics. He was into multi-track, and by that I mean he'd put down like the lead part of the guitar, you know, da 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 da, and then on another track it'd be da 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 da. He'd play the harmony, and then he'd mix them together. And he was warping my mind. I said, good gracious, he must have 10 fingers on each hand. I mean, he's doing so much. And I started trying to figure out. And then doing that, I learned how to pop my guitar strings with the fingers I was making the chords with. I kicked them up and back, and it kind of gave it a little click, 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 a little clicking sound, and it just kind of made it, I didn't realize it at the time, but it made this sound a little bit different to what the ordinary guys were doing. But it was Les Paul and his technique that really brought about, if I have a different style of guitar playing, it's because of him, really, and not knowing what he was doing and trying to copy him and couldn't.
I'm going to play your recording of Honey Don't. Tell me what you're doing on guitar on this.
Well, mostly I'm making a lot of mistakes and trying to remember where I made them and make them at the same place again, which is impossible when you don't know what you're doing to start with. But that song was a little bit ahead of its time. Back in that period, you had E, A, and B, like G, C, and D. These chords are pattern chords. They follow each other. And I went from E down to C. I said, you know, well, how come you say you will when you won't, da-da-da-da-da. And Scotty Moore, the guitar player with Elvis, I remember when I'd just written it, he said, you can't do that. You can't go from E down to C. I said, why can't I? He said, it don't fit. I said, well, it don't sound that bad. And it was different. But that's what's going on with that song, Honey Don't. It was a little bit, I think, maybe before its time, melody-wise, because I did go from E to C, but that's about all I did. But it was a little different.
Carl Perkins, recorded in 1996. He died yesterday at the age of 65. We'll hear more of the Perkins interview in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
You say you will when you won't. You tell me you do, baby, when you don't. Let me know, honey, how you feel. Tell the truth now, is love real? Oh, honey, don't. Well, honey, don't. Honey, don't. No, honey, don't. Hey, honey, don't. Say you will when you won't. Honey, don't. Baby, and you ought to know, I like the way that you wear your clothes. Everything about you is so doggone sweet. You got that sand all over your feet. So, hey, honey, don't.
For tapes or transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime, 1-888-NPR-NEWS. Also, Fresh Air interviews are now available online at www.audible.com/freshair.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our 1996 interview with Carl Perkins, the king of rockabilly, and hear about his first big break at Sun Records.
I work all day as a soda jerk on my feet all the time, and oh man, how they hurt. Don't make much, but I sure get the news. I don't have much time for getting the blues. My friends drop in for sodas and pop. They're all talking plans about a new record hop. All day long, I'm a filling on, taking in nickels, dimes, and quarters, cherry sodas and a chocolate shake, strawberry sundaes and a lemon phosphate. Time to clean the fountain, cause it's almost 5 and
You know me, Dad, after five I jive. I wanna jive. I wanna jive. Ooh, I wanna jive. Yes, after five. Just work here, Dad. I'm not the founder. I keep a working and a watching the clock. I'm peeping out the window for my baby to stop. We'll head out of town to a little night dive. Because you know me, Dad, after five I jive. All day long I'm filling oars, taking in nickels.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our 1996 interview with Carl Perkins. He died yesterday at the age of 65. Perkins was an originator of rockabilly, the music that in the mid-50s first brought together country and rock and roll. His best-known songs are Blue Suede Shoes and Honey Don't. Perkins' biggest hits were recorded at Sun, the Memphis record label, which also first recorded Elvis Presley. There's a great story about how you ended up going to Memphis to record at the Sun Studios. Your wife heard Elvis Presley on the radio singing Blue Moon of Kentucky, and she called you and she said, look, there's someone on the radio who sounds like you, because you and Elvis were both putting together country music, rhythm and blues, and rock and roll. And when you heard that, you went right to Memphis to the Sun Studios to see if Sam Phillips would record you too.
You're right about that.
So was he willing to give you a shot right away? Did you have to work hard to convince him?
If I hadn't have felt that was my only opportunity, I wouldn't even turned around. I'd have put it in reverse and backed back to Jackson, because he wasn't there when I walked in. My brothers were sitting out in the car, and I went into the little front office there, and a lady by the name of Maren Kassler, who was Sam Phillips' secretary, who was really the lady who found Elvis Presley. She told Sam about this good-looking boy and how unique he sang. He came in to make a record for his mama. He paid $3 for it. It was called Memphis Recording Service then. But I walked in, and I guess she could tell by looking at me that I was a hungry guitar picker. And she said, if you come to audition, you're out of luck, because we got this boy Elvis, and he's more than we can handle. So Mr. Phillips is not listening to anybody. I said, well, I appreciate it. It's all right. We set out front for a while till he gets here. And just a few seconds after, or a few minutes really after that, he pulled in, and he got a little close to my old Plymouth, because I was in his parking place and right in front door. And he whipped in there in that two-tone 54 Cadillac Coupe de Ville. I never will forget it. It was dark blue and light blue, and he got out. He had on a dark blue pair of pleated pants with a light blue coat. I said, wow, that's either Elvis Presley or the cat that owns this place. And I beat him to the front door. I had my foot in the door. I said, Mr. Phillips, I'm Carl Perkins. That's my brother sitting there in the car. And I was talking 90 miles an hour. We come down. We want to make a record for you. He said, I'm too busy, man. He told me after that, he said, Carl, I don't know why I listened to you. I had no intentions. I was wrapped up with what I was going to do to get records pressed of this boy Elvis. But you look like your world would have ended. And I said, Mr. Phillips, it might have. Because my heart was, I was just aching to get in that studio. I just felt, with encouragement from my wife, I thought, I can't let Val down. I got to get in there. And we did.
So Sam Phillips gave you a shot. What did he do, ask you to play a lot of your songs?
He asked me, my brother Jay had a couple of songs that he'd written, So Jay started doing one that he'd written, and he stopped him after about one verse. He said, I've got anything else. He did another one and got about that far, and he stopped him again. Jay liked a country singer by the name of Ernest Tubb and had developed a style like him because he loved him so much, and he sounded a little bit like him. And I never will forget, Mr. Phillips said, boy, there's already an Ernest Tubb. You need to forget about him. Your song's pretty good, but I can't use you guys. And I didn't realize, we didn't know, the microphone was still on, and he was back in the control room. I said, boys, don't put them. They started to put their instruments, you know, back in the cases, and I said, don't put them up. I'm going to do him one of mine. I said, please don't. We can't leave here. But he was hearing this, and he heard a convicted little old skinny arm boy by the name of Carl Perkins that when I got the shot, he walked back through there. I said, Mr. Phillips, will you listen to one of my songs? He said, yeah, take off. So he stood there. But I got real nervous because after I got past the first verse, he hadn't stopped me. And I thought, oh, Lord, he's going to listen to the whole song. And I got to jumping around, and the first thing he said to me after I did that, he said, that's a cute song, I like it. He said, can you sing Standing Still? He said, you're going to have to, because if you ever make a record, you're going to have to stand still. I said, yes, sir, I can do whatever you tell me to. And he said, well, I like that song. Go home and write you another one in that vein, and we'll talk about putting a record out. So, on the way back to Jackson in a 40 model Plymouth, I must have written 10 or 15 songs on the dashboard. And I called him back in a couple of weeks, and I had a thing he liked. It was a country song called Turn Around. So, the first one I ever did for him was a song I wrote when I was 14 years old called Movie Mag. And Turn Around was on the other side, and that was my first record.
Well, why don't we hear "Turnaround," your first recording? And this is different from what we've heard. This isn't this is more of a country ballad than an up-tempo rockabilly song.
Yeah. Now the song on the other side was a rockabilly country thing called Movie Mag, but he liked. I tell you what, he told me. He said, "This boy Elvis is doing. I know where your heart is, but he's got that ball and going with it, and I can't have two you cats sounding a lot alike and singing this up-tempo, we call it feel-good music. There was no word, no name for it at that point. Some of the hillbillies in Nashville, I think rockabilly sprang out of there. They said, you know, them boys in Memphis are rocking our music. So it got called rockabilly, and it kind of stuck there. But He didn't feel like that he had room for Elvis and I doing the same kind of music. So he told me, he said, I'm gonna put out this song, Turn Around. And then he put out another record called Let the Jukebox Keep on Playing. On the back side of that one was a rockabilly song called Gone, Gone, Gone. And then he sold Elvis to RCA Victor, and he said, now you can rock. And that's when I came up with Blue Suede Shoes and Honey Don't.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, why don't we hear the country ballad that you wrote,
All right.
Turn Around.
Okay.
When you're all alone and blue and the world looks down on you, turn around, I'll be following you. When you feel that love is gone and you realize you're wrong, turn around, I'll be following you. Turn around, I'll be waiting behind you with a love that's real and never, ever dies. If you feel your love will last, and you'd like to live your past, turn around, I'll be following you.
We're featuring a 1996 interview with Carl Perkins, who died yesterday at the age of 65. We'll hear the final part of the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our 1996 interview with rockabilly pioneer Carl Perkins. After the rockabilly era, sometime in the early 60s, your music wasn't doing that well commercially anymore, and you decided to give up music back then. Why did you want to give it up?
Well, I was drinking a lot. I was drinking because I thought, I really can't pinpoint why I got so deep into alcohol. I thought it was erasing memories. It was causing me maybe to dodge the real problems that were out there for me, and that was the crowds were falling off, my music was suffering, but alcohol was causing most of this. You can't write, I couldn't. I'm not speaking, for anybody but myself. Alcohol cannot play a guitar very good. It can't write, and it can't sing. And I was going to the bottom of the barrel, and I started trying to get off of it, and that's when I decided, well, if I get away from the business and just get out on a farm, maybe I can conquer this. But I couldn't stay away from the alcohol. Thank God I had a good church-going wife who kept raising my children in the right direction and praying that I'd see the light. And one day I did, and life's been wonderful ever since. But it got bad for a while. It sure did.
Now, after you started feeling forgotten and neglected in America, you became a real hero in England. The Beatles did some of your songs, including Honey Don't.
Yeah.
How did you end up getting so popular there? Did you tour England?
Yeah, I did. I went over in 1964 with Chuck Berry, who had not been to England at that time. And the tour was very, very successful. And this was before the Beatles came to America, a month or two before they came. And I met them over there and come find out, they told me that they'd been listening to a lot of my old Sun records and liked what I did and kind of inspired them. I think the inspiration I gave the Beatles was the fact that I wrote my own songs, I played my own lead guitar, and sang my own songs, and this is what they were doing. And they said, because you did it, we figured we could. So they made their own music, wrote their own songs, and sang them. And if I inspired them, it was in that way. I don't think, and never will think, that it was my quality of music. Although George Harrison does hit a little lick or two that I used on some of my earlier records, but he does it so much better than I ever did. But you're right. I have been pretty successful in England, and I still go over every year, and most of the years I'll do a couple of tours over there. Rockabilly music's held up real well, and for some reason or another, old Carl Perkins just feels good over there with those kids. They won't sit down, and I come alive and rock with them, and thank God for it. I've been able to make a living there when I couldn't back in America,
Now, you also played with Johnny Cash for about 10 years, traveling with him in his roadshow.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
Johnny Cash stopped by my house back in 1965. And he stopped by to see me. I'd had an accident. I shot my foot with a shotgun, and I was in a cast. And he stopped by to see me, and he invited me to go with him. He was going to play in Atlanta and Chattanooga. And he said, I'll bring you back in a couple of days. You need to get out. So I did. I went with him. He called me out on the stage with crutches and a cast, and I did blue suede shoes. And, you know, I worked a lot, recorded with John back on Sun Records, and I liked him very much. John grew up kind of like I did, a poor sharecropper's son over in Arkansas, and we remained good friends through the years. And so from those 2 days, it turned into 10 years. I found a safe place to be that I got off of alcohol. Cash had problems at that time. We quit together. And, you know, the Statler brothers were part of his show, Mother Maybelle and the Carter family. There was not a lot of drinking around me. I surrounded myself, and I just changed my routine. I stayed away from the places that I would drink at, and the load really was on Johnny Cash's shoulder. It was his show, and I just opened, and it took the pressure. There's a lot of pressure when you are the star, you know, and... it was a comfortable place for me to be, and I'm glad of the 10 years that I had with Johnny Cash. He's a wonderful man.
It sounds like there was a little AA group within Johnny Cash's roadshow.
You better believe it, child. There really was. And it was stemmed and steered and with a steady hand by a wonderful, sweet lady by the name of Maybelle Carter.
Mm-hmm.
She would tell John and I late at night sitting on that bus, said, see, you made another day. Both of you sober and you're looking so good. Let's sing. And we'd go down the road. It was very, very touching. Those years with that sweet, gentle lady, she had a lot to do with the turnaround that happened with Johnny Cash and Carl Perkins.
Now, what's your touring schedule like now?
It's pretty big, Terry. I just returned from Switzerland. I went over. I've had 3 dates there. I'm doing about 100 dates a year. So I'm still out there working. I've got two of my sons that plays with me, my drummer, my bass player, two other guys who seem like my sons. I'm happy. I'm sober. I'm knowing from where it all comes from, and I'm out there trying to show the people I love them, and I work as hard as I possibly can for them, and it's a beautiful life. It really is.
Now, you have a new autobiography called Go Cat Go. There's
yeah.
also a new record called Go Cat Go, on which you perform duets with a
yeah.
lot of people, including Tom Petty, Paul Simon, Willie Nelson.
Johnny Cash,
yeah. Now,
Paul McCartney, George Harrison, John Lennon.
I'm going to play a track I particularly like from this, and it's the opening track. It's a duet with you and John Fogerty,
Who
came to success with Creedence Clearwater.
Right.
And this is All Mama's Children. Would you say something about the song or recording it?
You know, I really like to say the wrong thing. I was out in L.A., and John Fogerty came to the studio. We had pre-planned this and everything. And I said, what do you want to do, John? What song? He said, I want to do All Mama's Children, your old record. I said, that's the sorriest song I ever wrote in my life. And I always detested that song. I think it's a piece of garbage. And he looked really hurt. He said, are you kidding? I said, no, that song ain't no good, man. He said, it's the best Carl Perkins song you ever had. Well, I knew he said it with sincerity, so he meant it, so I backed off quick. I said, well, it ain't that bad. You know, I didn't want him to say, if we don't do this one, I'm going home. And we jumped in there, and a couple of takes, we had it. It was a great delight making this album with people like John Fogerty, Tom Petty. I did not know I knew of him. He's a great artist. And here I am in Los Angeles having so much fun with these guys. All this adds up to, gosh, Terry, I got to be one of the luckiest old rockabillies still around.
Well, I'm glad you're still recording. I really enjoy this.
Thank you so much
for talking with us.
Oh, it's been a treat, girl. Anytime, just holler. Carl Perkins will be on this end of the line. Thank you so very much.
Carl Perkins, recorded in 1996. He died yesterday at the age of 65.
There was an old woman that lived in a shoe. She had so many children she didn't know what to do. They were doing all right till she took them to town. The kids stopped picking them up and putting them down. All your children wanna rob the mama. All your children wanna roll. They wanna roll. Shoot.
Carl Perkins and John Fogerty. In order to bring you our interview with Carl Perkins today, we postponed our conversation between mystery writer P.D. James and Fresh Air book critic Maureen Carrigan. We'll bring you that tomorrow. Coming up, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz plays some rare piano recordings that are now back in print. This is Fresh Air. A few months ago, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz talked about a little-known American pianist named George Copeland, who made few recordings. None of them were in print. Now the picture has changed. The British label Pearl has just released a 2-CD set of Copeland's complete Victory recordings from the 1930s, plus excerpts from his last live concert. Here's Lloyd's review.
Talk about serendipity. George Copeland was an American pianist whose rare recordings I'd loved for years. The person who triggered my recent piece about him on Fresh Air was a friend who was curious if I'd ever heard of him. Copeland had been a friend of his family. He'd even given my friend a few piano lessons. Then after the broadcast, I got a note from a listener in Memphis thanking me for explaining the mysterious figure on an old concert poster he'd found years ago at a garage sale. I also got a call from another friend who knew someone who was working on a new George Copeland album. That album has just been released. The liner notes on it by Charles Timbrell tell me more about Copland than I'd ever known before. That, for instance, he had toured with Isadora Duncan, accompanying her dancers and playing piano solos. That Copland had played the world premiere of two Debussy etudes, and that he was playing the first American performances of Debussy as early as 1905. And who but Copland would have insisted on placing the microphones under his piano to capture the particularly diaphanous quality of Debussy's prelude, Veils? Debussy once said to him, "It is not my habit to pay compliments, but I wish to say, Mr. Copland, that I never thought to hear my music played as well as that in my lifetime." This is the opening of Copland's own insinuating transcription of Debussy's Prelude to the Afternoon of a Faun. Copland's wealthy Boston father was opposed to his son's musical career, but his Spanish mother encouraged it, which helps explain Copland's devotion to Baroque and modern Spanish music. This generous new album includes the expected variety of French, Spanish, and Latin American composers recorded in the 1930s, but there are also some happy surprises, such as this breathless Bach Passapied. Especially cherish the chance to hear Copland perform live on never previously issued recordings of a 1964 concert. In fact, his very last at Yale when he was 82 years old. He died at 89. I had no idea these recordings existed. He was still playing with his singular, instantly identifiable combination of delicacy and power. The exquisite touch, his trademark, teasing rhythms and captivating phrasing that critics were already praising before the turn of the century, were all still there more than half a century later.
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a new 2-CD set of piano recordings by George Copland on the Pearl label. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Alan Tu, with Monique Nazareth. Research assistance from Sarah Scher. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publisher of Buzz Bissinger's A Prayer for the City, which chronicles hope and heartbreak in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.